Hi, this is Amelia. Hello? Nobody there.
Hello?
Hi, this is Amelia.
No, this is Darlene.
Hi, Darlene.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
Good, real good. Thank you. A little tired.
You're tired, huh?
Hello, this is Pamela.
Hi, Pamela. Hi, this is Amelia.
Hello. How are y'all doing?
Doing great. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Well, welcome. This is Dave. I'm impressed that all of you are here on a Memorial Day holiday. I hope it's been great for you, and I appreciate your coming. I'm eager to have our third seminar unfold. I want to check first if there are questions or clarifications or any aspects from our first two seminars that you'd like to discuss a bit more before we launch into our third. Anything at all to discuss or clarify or ask about? We're going to be talking today about a systematic way to understand a story, the algorithms of behavior, of attachment, of emotional patterns, about how we construct our stories, meaning also about how we deconstruct our stories. And we're going to use the example of a career change to apply this to change and transition to put us into an example that will be in the flow of what we've been talking about. But any other, I appreciate the emails that you've sent, the answers to the questions and other kind words. Anything that you want to ask or talk about as we launch our seminar? I've incorporated your questions and the things that you want to be sure you get out of this into what I plan to discuss and have discussed, so I'm hoping it really hits at the heart of that. Final call?
I do have a quick question.
Yes, this is good. I was feeling lonely. Who is this?
Hi, this is Denise.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good.
Great.
I wasn't sure if we had class today, so I was
a little late.
I
did not notice that when we scheduled at the beginning of the whole academic year, and I didn't want to burden any of you by extending it, so I thought it would be easier to listen than it would be to tackle on. So, but yeah, thanks. Your question.
Yes, my question is, I'm also taking the coach training program through CTA, and it is, you know, when I went to school many, many years ago, my major was psychology and my minor was communication. One of the things I've noticed about coaching is that I have to be careful not to advise people or help them come to their realization, like Like, how do I, is your course going to help separate the two or maybe even combine how I can do coaching and use my psychology skills?
Well, I think that you ask a good question, and it's always an orientation and a focus for us in doing mentor coaching to keep the client's story in the foreground. The point of reference for the client is always his or her story, and what we're doing is helping them to develop that story and to achieve the goals that they have to make it a cohesive story and an understandable story. Maybe looking at the roadmap that we'll do, the acronym for the seven steps, is going to help with that. But I think it's really an orientation, because with a background in psychology, which I know can be very helpful, can I get you to cover, mute if you're going to call for Steve, whoever that is, because your microphone picks it up very loud and clear, and it's like it's next door. As you know from my approach already, that I integrate and synthesize the mind and brain sciences, psychology, neuroscience, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, a number of things, to look at how we can understand the process of change and how to make it permanent. And that's exactly what we're applying here. So I think all the benefits that you have in doing psychology and communication, those are two dynamite combinations. It's the orientation that you have in listening, that you're not going into the background of somebody and understanding more or looking at a problem or trying to revise an old story or come to the end of the past in any way. Our approach in coaching is to look at now and next, the choice architecture of here and now. And in terms of advice, what we don't do, basically, is to ghostwrite the client's story or to run in plays. Now, there may be a number of things that we do that further the process of the client getting to his or her goal. You know, at times, we may log in with our perspective or wondering if a client has thought about it a certain way. Or at times, if there's something that a client doesn't know or doesn't have access to, we may simply tell them. One of the CTA faculty, Dave Meyer, put it this way: if someone doesn't know what an AMWA is, you can't coach it out of them. And if knowing what an AMWA is crucial for that client, then they better well find out. Who better to tell them than you? So, asking powerful questions is the principle here, and it's the principle because that appreciative inquiry boots up a particular mindset at the beginning of a conversation. It's part of conversational intelligence that we know that the first words from someone will boot up a mindset that will process the remainder of the conversation. And when that's collaborative and collegial, then it's going to be very, very productive. When it's a question that looks at possibility, then that boots up a very different mindset than a question about a problem. Because that way you're into the old grooves in your brain, and each time you revisit a problem, even ostensibly to resolve it, it etches it a little bit further each time. So it's the orientation that we have of helping the client develop his or her story in the very best way possible, and in my view, whatever it takes for the client to get to the point they want and their goals in their story, that they're writing it themselves, not getting advice from you or that you're running in plays, because that's your story and that may not work best for the client, and the client needs to hear that we believe in him or her, because that changes the perception and the mindset. Does that response make sense to you, and does it address your question?
Because they are very similar in the coaching sessions that in the classes, I've noticed that there are times where I kind of want to say well, have you thought about this? So that would be appropriate. Is that correct?
I can see a situation where it would be. So
okay.
What you're doing is you're a catalyst to help the client develop their stories. You're
mm-hmm.
not a mentor of telling them or conveying information to them. And you've heard me say before, if information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd all work out every day, eat most of the vegetables, have a lot of money saved up for the future. So it's not information that someone can best benefit in working. So let's apply then the roadmap system and see if it further answers your question and helps with that orientation, because this is a way to think about how to listen to a client's story, how to understand it, and then how to engage in order to create a change or a revised or new story. Okay, we're in lecture mode now, so you don't have to worry about the background noise. Think about this for just a minute. What's the number one addiction we have as humans? The most common addiction that every human being experiences. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves. Problems are the biggest addiction we have. We always come back to a problem because we know exactly what it is. It can activate our discussion, and we know all about it. They give us an effective focus, but they keep us in that same well-worn path in the snow. So, here's a brief review and overview. Much of our behavioral and emotional responses are automatic. Neuroscientists estimate, as we've discussed before, that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. This means that the vast majority of our responses are based on established algorithms for behavioral, emotional, and attachment patterns. The shadow story, the operating system that's mostly on unconscious autopilot. Our lives are filled with these script patterns of how we respond to situations. As we repeat certain patterns, our brain wires those as the default mode. The script for each scenario in our lives operates usually without conscious thought. At a family gathering or a board meeting, we tend to sit in the same seat each time. We look over the menu, but order the same thing. The roadmap system now is the acronym for the 7 steps to understand the algorithms of behavior, emotion, attachment. It's a strategic way to deconstruct and understand personally constructed stories and how to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior. So I would encourage you to listen to this and think about it as applied to you, then you'll be in the best position to apply it to clients. And remember, the approaches to changing behavior that work, consider what those changes do to your personal stories. So in other words, the final step facilitates the development of corresponding new identity to sustain this significant change. So, we're going to look at the roadmap system using the example of career transition. Now, this is in your outline, so you don't have to take notes. Listen to see if it makes sense to you. So, remember, the roadmap is the acronym for the 7 steps to understand and revise or create a new story. Step 1, recognize your career story. If you were to configure it as a shape, what would it be? A trajectory, a circle, a bell curve, a flat line. Clearly describe your career story as it exists now. Then describe what you want in a new career story. If someone wants to make a career change, are they fully informed about the one they're in now and wanting to leave? For example, if someone's only performed at maybe 80 or 85% capacity, concluded that their job or career is not rewarding, then decide to move on, they don't have the information they need. They can't make an informed decision of what it's like to operate at 100% capacity. In other words, they can't do an apples-to-apples comparison because they're going to compare what they're functioning and experiencing now with what they anticipate of 100% capacity in a new career. And it's likely that the same process that resulted in a ceiling at 80% now is going to be repeated in the new situation. So, a question here. At what percent of your capacity are you functioning in your work now? And if it's not 100%, that's your coachable moment. Explore why. Have you ever performed at 100% of your capacity? Do you know what it's like to be fully successful in your current position so that you can make an informed decision? Here's a brief story to illustrate. At the beginning of my career as a psychiatrist, for a small part of my professional time, I served as a consultant for the Institute of Rehabilitation and Research. It was right across the street from Baylor College of Medicine, and I did that only a small part of time, but it was intriguing, working with people who had become physically disabled in adolescence or adulthood, often as the result of an accident. It's the place that Congresswoman Gabby Gifford came. Not surprisingly, some of these individuals considered suicide as an alternative to a lifetime of disability. Instead of trying to convince them not to kill themselves, I indicated that I could understand their feelings about the overwhelming change in their life. Suicide was at least one way they could control something about their life, especially when fundamental body control was now out of reach. I recognized that at that moment in time, the idea of suicide, of being able to control one thing in their lives to know they could end the pain, was the hope that paradoxically allowed them to keep living. They needed that choice. I recommended that we work together to achieve their full capacity now, recognizing it was at a different level since the onset of disability. Only achieving their full potential at their new level could they make an informed decision about whether they truly wanted to live or not live as a physically challenged individual. I told them that I would completely understand if, after achieving full capacity and then being able to make an informed decision, if they decided to die, I would respect that decision. I worked with several hundred people over a period of 5 years. Thankfully, no one decided to die after going through full physical and emotional rehabilitation and achieving a new, though different, level of functioning. Step two, own your career story, especially your needs and ideals. Be clear about needs and ideals, if and how they align with passion and purpose and experience. When your passion and experience combine, terrific possibilities emerge. So, a question here, what do you want in your career? And listen for whether the client is getting away from something or going towards something, or rarely both. Distinguish temporary frustration from permanent dissatisfaction. Be cautious about confusing dissatisfaction, disillusionment, or even burnout with terminal disillusionment. Before you can distinguish temporary from permanent, someone may need to realign or recommit to a career. Keep in mind that choosing the wrong career may be every bit as easy as it was the first time if the wrong career was chosen then. One client, for example, spoke of a particular storyline that she had recognized and bought into. She indicated she was not addicted to work itself or to money or the things that money bought, but felt she was addicted to her work ethic, to the pursuit of perfection. More became a goal. More money, more work was what it just focused on. The story of the pursuit of money became a substitute for other stories. The ideal of more, of course, lacked an endpoint, so she never felt satisfied or validated. She had become exhausted with the perpetual series of occasions for hope of being perfect yet never quite getting there. And that's how we began mentor coaching. I want to return to her situation in a moment. Step three, assess your career story. Remember that a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in your brain, a physical part of a neuronal network. So, just as a teacher can't present a simple explanation and remove an existing neural network from a student's brain, you can't just list three reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's networks and pathways. But change can occur as a process, not an event, and it's an inside job. This step is to assess beliefs to see if they're working, if they're limiting, and if so, to try out other beliefs. What's another way to look at this? How might your thoughts be limiting you? Are there questions that you're afraid to ask? What do you really want? What do you need to let go of? What is present and what is missing in a current career? What information do you need to make an informed decision? So questions here would be, what would your career and life be like if you already had what you wanted? What is it costing you personally and financially to not have what you want? And remember, as a mentor coach, to listen for a distinction of internal dissatisfaction from job dissatisfaction. Internal struggles and unhappiness are often blamed on a job, just like a marriage. People want to change the obvious external cause rather than to look inside. Sometimes people even create job struggles to externalize unhappiness or conflict in an attempt to escape or to pose a recognizable remedy. Then the supposed way to get rid of the problem is to leave it. Same thing can happen in a marriage. Step four, decide on a plan and how to make it work. Align needs and ideals with purpose and passion focused on a goal. You decide where you can make the greatest contribution. You want to stay informed and engaged at whatever you do, although it may be different than what you've done, say, for three or more decades. It means that you'll examine again your fundamental strengths, your needs, your ideals. Perhaps for the first time, you will be self-directed, self-organized. No corporate structure or job to fit into and govern your day. Nobody who's paying a salary to you deciding what you do and what your schedule is. You will need to cultivate a deep understanding of yourself, your strengths and weaknesses, how you learn, how you work with others, and where you can make the greatest contribution. A question here, how would working with me get you where you want to be? Now, to return to the client pursuing perfection, her medical practice was booming, yet she wasn't enjoying it or feeling fulfilled, only looking to the next task to do perfectly. I highlighted a pattern that I noticed. It seemed that as soon as she began enjoying her work, really immersed in it, she began procrastinating. She would put off completing a piece of work, which restored her old feeling of dread and vague guilt about what she should be doing. When I pointed out this pattern, at the time it was on medical records, she recognized it. It prompted her insight. She said, it's like work has always needed to be work. The minute I began to feel pleasure at my work or my practice, I began to feel vaguely guilty because I should be working. And she likened that to an attachment pattern she had with a very successful father who always wanted to see her working. So one possibility here is to create a vision of success at your specific goals. Include all sensory details, all experiences of successfully arriving at your goal. When you create a vision, you rewire your brain. When you have a story of affirmations, you revise your mind software. Having a plan supersedes motivation and not feeling like doing something. you don't need to feel motivated in order to do something. You just have to have a plan and stick to it. For example, your plan is every Monday from 3 to 5 you work on your marketing. You're not motivated to work on marketing. You probably don't feel like it. But if it's Monday at 2:59, you know where you're going to be at 3 and stay there till 5 and stick to your plan. Step 5, map a new story. Where, when, how to begin. SMART goals, initiatives, next best action. And navigate with the brain's error detection mechanism. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. Now, discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains also have an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center when we do something different and initiate change that says, this isn't normal. So, this is something to reframe, to understand and reframe as validation of moving ahead, as a signpost of doing something different and being in new territory. Now, the error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamic factors. We notice differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong while maybe struggling to list our strengths. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off an error detection response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before consideration, placing another barrier to resist change, which is another aspect of the response to Denise's question. Telling a client what to do may trigger the error detection mechanism. Focus on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. That's one of the reasons we get so addicted to problems. Bad news gets our attention for the same reason. The mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, such as stress, or in childhood, or an earlier attachment pattern, may not apply in a current situation. The hardwiring is not permanent, and it can be revised. This is where understanding the elements of how we construct a story, the roadmap system and process itself, understanding the algorithms that are invisible, but yet we can see and infer what we do and how we're organized. So, the brain's error detection mechanism can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. New maps are created. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, such as collaborative, contingent conversations, exactly what we do, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. Choice architecture is an art and a science. People can be nudged toward decisions that will improve their lives in healthy and wealthy directions. We are susceptible to biases that can lead us to make decisions that are unhealthy, uneconomical, short-sighted. When we consider how people think, we can even design environments of choice that make it easier for people to pick better options. Co-create new stories together. Step 6, author changes. Implement the plan to reach goals. Someone needs the correct paradigm. Changing careers means changing paradigms. A mistake of extrapolation to predict the future based on the past would be to assume that a present experience would apply to a new career. You just changed the setting. Even if you go from head of HR at one large multinational oil company to another, this is a client example, in the same city, the culture is worlds apart, and a huge change and transformation was necessary. The correct paradigm would be not only about the process, but the content of the new career and the process of change itself. assumptions within a paradigm need to be examined for correctness. For example, in making a transition from medical practice to coaching, I assumed getting clients would be similar to getting therapy and analytic patients. For me, that was to share my work and thinking, to occasionally present a paper or write a book. My secretary would take the calls and put patients on the waiting list. Well, wrong for coaching. Coaching is a profession, but it's also a business. Marketing is a world of difference. My mentor coach drugged me kicking and screaming into marketing. So, one question here. Who else needs to be involved in your plan? Step 7. Program new experiences and then incorporate them into your identity. Both the change and transition involve changing a core identity. Your identity is the story you tell yourself about yourself, what you're willing to consider, what you'll do, what you won't do. Identity is a set of beliefs that relate to who you are as a person, what you can, what you will or won't do. When changes don't last, it's usually because someone has not changed their identity. The most powerful force of the human psyche is that we always return to our identity. So if simple changes of behavior are made without addressing one's internal model and identity, the change won't last. Our identity, remember, is not what I do, but who I am. We stay consistent with our own personal definition, whatever it is. So, for successful and productive work, here are some principles related to career that I wanted to conclude this portion with. Time is not an adequate measure of hard work. Hard work is not an adequate measure of performance or success. A work ethic is not the same as a productivity or success ethic. Think about somebody who's, I've been at my desk 8 hours, or I've been at my desk straight on for 10 hours today. That may be a work ethic, but it's not a success ethic. What have you accomplished? What has your productivity been? If possible, delegate everything other than what you're uniquely good at, what you do uniquely well. Time management is energy management. Stress regulation is energy management. Follow your passion and know your optimum state of mind, your zone, to accomplish each specific task. Know how to enter your optimum state of mind, how to get to your zone from our discussion in the last seminar. When your passion and your expertise combine, deciding possibilities occur. Structure gives you freedom. And finally, if you're thinking of retiring, consider retirement as a new career. What is its mission and purpose? The business plan. The difference your wisdom will make in this career. Finally, consider this possibility. When you reach a point in your life that you can celebrate the freedom to work rather than freedom from work, that's success. Now, let's look a little bit more at operating systems here. Now that we have the 7-step process of understanding how stories are constructed. Behavioral patterns and belief systems downloaded especially from parents in the first years of life become automatic and operate without our even being aware of. They are automatic. Neuroscientists estimate that 90 to 95% of our behaviors and our patterns of attachment, of emotion, are pre-programmed in the unconscious mind and operate on autopilot. So what this means, and this is what you can think about, how do you listen for this with a client? We may create two stories that can go in the opposite direction. For example, when the surface story is, I want to generate more income and create wealth. But the shadow story, may or may not be conscious, and it can go in the opposite direction. Well, I don't really think I was made to make big money, or I don't think I have what it takes, or what if I did all of this and then still failed? I'd really be embarrassed. Or, you know, look at all the time it's going to take away from my family and the work, and there's no guarantee. I think I'll just settle on what I have. Another example, the surface story. I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority. The shadow story, I can't have total authority because my partner acts like I'm taking it away. So, mentoring requires us to be insightful, reflective, and self-observant, to have mindfulness of ourselves in order to be empathically attuned to the mind and experience of a client. So, considerations, this is kind of a footnote, but it's also a reminder. Considerations of a career or any transition need to be considered in conjunction with developmental phases of the individual within that career, as well as where the individual is in life development. Needs and ideals need to be considered in terms of life phase. The developmental issues more in the foreground of a certain life phase, such as midlife or near retirement, can determine how someone views a career, the challenges, or the desire to change careers. So, once a plan is put into action, ongoing assessment can include these four areas: to monitor your choices, to continue questioning your ideas, to probe your reasoning, and always to ask clearly and honestly, does it work? Rather than inhabiting the story that you want to believe and just doing it a little bit harder. So, here are some mentor coaching applications. Challenge your mindset. For example, if you see every task as an improvable skill and how you can get better rather than just getting it done, a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. Approach work with new perspectives, more simply, more abstractly, deeper, more synthetically. Think long term. The place of your work in a system. Get feedback from other sources, multiple sources, including outside your field. Do these approaches consistently. It's what distinguishes the super achievers. So, let's look at how do we engineer effectiveness. Let's review, and these are some essentials of engineering effective change that you're familiar with, but I want to highlight them and put them in a perspective here. As you know, focus specifically on the next step. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope, a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Since he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop, but he managed to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was interviewed immediately after the race and asked how did he keep going when he was exhausted and physically challenged. He said, "I just kept running to the next telephone pole." A perfect example of shrinking the change. To specify the next step, not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. 3, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going, to measure progress along the way, to tell what's detour and what's distraction. A map does all of that. Make progress measurable. A specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step, so you track your progress. Make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible, with celebration of each small victory. When that's done in a coaching context, that has the effect of revising the model of how and who someone is, of helping them evolve and transform their identity along with the changes that they're making in their lives. The best example of shrinking a task to a tangible next item may be Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. A small target leads to small victories and the cumulative experience then of effectiveness and mastery. You know, to say that another way, in life, all we ever need to do is the next right thing. This shrinks the change to immediate steps of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. So, we've just adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. The scientific method is a challenge. To create a mindset of inquiry can generate discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. Now, to bring this together, there are a dozen AAA principles of change to author a transition story. The AAA principles of change: awareness, acceptance, and action. Here are the 12 principles. You're writing your own story. Is it working? For each component, what are the results? Honestly assess each of these storylines with a question of, is it working, and make it a yes or no. Your personal wellness story, mind, body, spirit. Your business career story. Your relationship story. Your money story. A not so secret to success is that you have to pay in full for that success. So, you might as well find out what the price is. Pay it in full, pay it as soon as possible, and then enjoy the benefits of success. The price is always some form of energy, whether that energy is money, time, work, or experience. If you get something for which you haven't provided value or benefit, you'll still have to pay in some way. Another non-secret: people who truly enjoy getting what they want are those who enjoy paying the price. I'm doing it right now. I love this. I believe it will really make a difference in your lives and for your clients. So it's really not paying. It's really not a price. It's a passion. Two, you're writing your own story. It takes just as much energy to create any belief in your story, positive or negative, past, present, future, adaptive or maladaptive, the same energy. The belief of scarcity takes just as much energy as the belief of abundance. You generate the energy and give power to your story. When you use your attention to focus on what you don't have, you simply deplete your energy to engage what you do have. Here's the subtle but crucial distinction. You give specific power to your story, and it assumes a momentum and power of its own. And remember, you're not the subject of that process. You're the creator of it. You're not the victim. You're the author. Here's a short list of some results when you focus on what you don't want. Fear, anxiety, anger, confusion, annoyance, helplessness, guilt. Three, you're writing your own story. Decide what you want. The primary reason people don't get what they want is they're not quite sure what they want. Here's a neuroscience and law of attraction question. How does the brain work like a travel agent? The first two questions a travel agent asks, where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? A goal is like MapQuest. You program where you want to go, you make a map, and determine the time, and then create the strategy to get there. A caveat here: to know what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is but you can almost always know what it isn't. And consider this. What you resist, you draw toward you. The reason resistance is an engagement. It's kind of analogous to anger is as passionate an attachment as love. So, if you find yourself resisting change, it's already occurred. And most suffering is the result of resisting what already is. People resist going to the doctor. They aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. 4, you're writing your own story. Do you have specific measurable goals? In a Harvard study begun in the mid-1950s, 15% of the Harvard Business School graduates fashioned a vision and had specific goals for their life and business. 5 decades later, those 15% had 90% of the assets of the entire group. There was a similar study, a longitudinal study done on Dartmouth undergraduates, and the statistics there were only 3% had fashioned specific goals. They ended up, guess what, 97% of the assets of the entire group. Motivation increases as soon as you're clear about the goal and the payoff, and the closer someone gets to the goal, the more motivated they feel. Focus enhances when you have a specific plan and strategy. So, it's estimated that less than 10% of people actually have measurable goals. 100% of people have good ideas, at least some. The difference between a good idea and a goal? Measurement and time. Where and when? The travel agent questions. Here's a good idea. I'd like to lose some weight. Here's a goal. I will reach 185 pounds by my retreat in October in California. Here's a good idea. I want to save more money for retirement. Here's a goal. I will pay myself first by setting up an automatic transfer to my retirement fund from my checking account the first day of each month for X amount. Then, write a breakthrough goal, something would stretch you, bring incredible opportunities, move you to a higher level, quantum leap, getting a book on the New York Times bestseller list, spending every March skiing in Steamboat Springs, and every August riding on the coast of Maine, but substitute your own goals there. Then, reread your goals, regular and breakthrough, twice a day, when you wake up and when you go to bed. 5, you're writing your own story. Small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue to specify a step to take for progress. So divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. Just go to the next telephone pole. 6, you're writing your own story. Be consistent in the pursuit of your goals. Remember, it takes about 25 to 30 days to etch a new pathway in your brain to make a simple cause and effect habit permanent. Write your new story consistently for it to become the default mode. Guess who said this? It's not that I'm so smart. It's that I stay with problems longer. That was Albert Einstein. 7, you're writing your own story. The benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what isn't working will become self-evident and self-perpetuating. That doesn't need explanation. It's so simple. Good parents have known this for centuries, but sometimes it just takes human science and cognitive research to remind us of the obvious. And here's a simple application. Whatever you respond to will either sustain or enhance. So in your life, don't respond to the things that you don't want, don't like, or have no use for. 8, you're writing your own story. Ask for feedback to your spouse or partner. Ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, rate the quality of our relationship. To your employees or colleagues, on a scale of 1 to 10, how am I doing? Then, how can I get to 10? A tribe in southern Africa called the Babemba has an interesting practice. When they hear a story of a person doing something wrong, something that destroys the social net of their pike community, all work in the village halts. The people gather around the offender and one by one recite all that that person has done right in his life. Good deeds, responsible behavior, thoughtful acts. The honest feedback on misbehavior has a time-honored consequence to allow the person to reclaim the better part of himself. He remembers who he is and why he is important to the life of the village. This may have been the original 360-degree feedback. So even without this kind of network and feedback, we can relax and remember our way back into alignment with our true selves. We can get centered and reconnect with our true essence. This is a significant benefit of developing a mindfulness practice, that we can become self-aware and self-reflective in order to better self-regulate, as we discussed last seminar. Now, a sidebar here. You've probably noticed that each of these AAA principles of change that I've mentioned so far to author a new story or to address a change or transition began the same way. You're writing your own story. That's the first four steps of the roadmap. Recognize, observe, assess, and decide. Compressed into a shorthand of awareness and acceptance. The third A, mapping change and authoring new experience in 12 action steps. Step 9, number 9, you're writing your own story. Get success insurance instead of waiting for good luck. Luck is defined as probability taken personally, or narcissism meets chance, my personal favorite. A review on research and goal setting is in the work pages of your outline. They help us to understand. This was research done by one of the original founders in this country of executive coaching, Goldsmith. He looked at why people give up on goals. So what this means is that in understanding the most common reasons that people give up on goals, in order to recognize them and obviate them, to address them, that's success insurance. So flipped around, those are some principles of success insurance. Review those six most important reasons people give up on goals and the inverse of self of success insurance in the outline. 10, you're writing your own story. Take a chance. You didn't have a New York Times bestseller before you sent your manuscript to an agent. If you get it rejected, you still don't. What do you got to lose? What's the problem? You spent your whole life not having a New York Times bestseller. A young chiropractor just out of professional school wanted to open a practice in Carmel, California. He was told he would never make it. There's already one chiropractor for every 8 people in Carmel. He went to 12,500 homes, talked to 6,500 people. He asked 3 questions. Which location should I open my office, the north or west side of town? Should I have extra office hours between 7 and 9 in the morning or 5 to 7 in the afternoon? And which paper should I advertise in? He added as he was leaving, when I have an open house party, would you like an invitation? In his first month, he took in $72,500, and his first year he netted over $1 million. 11. You're writing your own story. It's never too late to start. So don't let conventional wisdom or limiting assumptions ghostwrite your story. Cliff Beyond was a 61-year-old Australian sheep herder. He heard about a cross-country race from Sydney to Melbourne and decided to enter. He showed up in Oshkosh overalls and work boots. The officials looked at him like he was crazy. They said, this is a race of over 800 kilos. The most seasoned runners in the world compete. Do you have any running experience or equipment? He said, yeah. I run after my sheep every day, and I got these boots and this baseball cap. So when the race began, the world-class runners took off as they trained to begin. Cliff started running along in his boots. He was supposed to run 18 hours and sleep 6, but nobody told Cliff this. And when the other runners were sleeping, he just kept shuffling along. He shuffled along for 3.5 days. He cut 5.5 hours off the world record. We each have beliefs that limit us. Find the story that will improve you and start believing that. If there were no barriers, what would your ideal life be? And finally, number 12, you're writing your own story. Everything is okay in the end. If it's not okay, it's not the end. Ed Lorenz conceptualized chaos theory in the 1960s in this way. The initial state of events may seem unrelated and random, but eventually a pattern emerges, and in the end, all the pieces fit together. It's the study of phenomena that appear random, but in fact have an element of regularity, which can be described eventually using a different organizing perspective. In the end, all the pieces fit together. We're in discussion mode. Thoughts, questions that you want to talk more about? Thank you for managing the background noise, each of you. Any questions or comments?
Yes, this is John in Nebraska.
Go ahead, thanks.
How do you... What is there a technique you utilize to reach the change resistant client?
I'm sorry, would you say that again? A technique to change what?
Do you have a technique you utilize that helps a change resistant client to realize change?
Yes. It's a principle that I operate on because every client is resistant. Each of us are resistant. We don't want to change. We want the world to change. We want other people to change. We don't want to change. And you know that, and I know that. So every client is resistant. So that's just a given because that's the way our minds and brains operate. Our brains, from an evolutionary perspective, whenever we do something repeatedly, it creates pathways and neuronal networks to make it automatic, to make it the default mode. It's energy efficient. And we don't want to change. We want other things to change. Now, when a client knows he or she needs to change, and one way to think about that as a mentor coach is not to take the resistance personally. Put your ego in a blind trust, but consider it this way. When a client is resistant, the client is doing absolutely the very best job possible to show you exactly what it's like to be him or her. That's all they can do. Think about this operating system that's 90 or 95% of the end product's operating system. How are they going to tell you what the algorithms are? How are they going to make conscious and logical and intellectual things they don't understand, the principles of which are out of awareness? So what they do is they come in and they talk about certain things, but then in the process, and this is where you make your money as a mentor coach, you can determine the process of what's going on and consider that the client is absolutely doing everything possible to show you what it's like to be him or her. That keeps it in a collaborative mode. It keeps the information focused. Together, your role is twofold. One is to create a working alliance with that client where you can get away with saying what you need to say. In other words, to be able to collaborate with that person, to be curious together about what they're doing and what ways could be done better to keep their goals in mind. One thing I would recommend, I think I mentioned it before, I was thinking, and I'm not sure if we got to it. There's a blog in my blog archives called We're Always Teaching Others. And it's an example of doing a mentor coaching demo for an organization that I helped create an internal mentoring program. It's one of the things I do for organizations. And that blog is based on one of the people who was in that organization going through training who agreed to work with me in a demo coaching. And it's an example of that, of bringing the process into focus, because your question really asks about, you know, how do we make the process the focus? Because the process is how we really understand these systems and these algorithms and these behavior and attachment and emotional patterns. We see what's manifest, because while you're talking about something else of what's conscious and logical, the important things are going to emerge, and they're going to emerge in the relationship. So the awareness of that and looking at it in that way is important, and that's why we can consider it the very best possible communication, because someone is showing us what it's like, and we don't take it personally. We don't get offended or, you know, counter their resistance or desire to not change with any kind of annoyance, but we really listen and collaborate together, and that's what our alliance does. Does that make sense to you for your question and what you had in mind in asking it?
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. It's a crucial question. It's something that I don't think we talk nearly enough about in mentor coaching, of looking at the process and how the process brings alive the very most important issues, because they're ones that a client can't really describe. It's easy enough to focus on, you know, a specific goal and strategies and that sort of thing, but this is where the real crux of mentor coaching comes into play, is how someone recreates a process with us, and we collaborate to look at that in a new way. So thanks for that question. I know we're out of time. If there are other questions or other comments you want to make about on anything we talked about, jot it down, and we'll begin right here next time. So thanks very much for your attendance, especially on a holiday weekend. And I hope this was useful and stimulating. We'll pick up right here next time for our final seminar. Thanks very, very much. Have a great week.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Have a nice week.
Good night. Hello.